But we're picking up with chapter 18, and I'll make the point that we're in this section where God is talking to the nation about ways of living that will help them to be holy. And remember, I discussed, and I don't remember the exact Hebrew, but the word for holy comes from a root that means different or separate. So one thing God tells his people, I want you to be different from everyone else. And he makes the point, I'm different. You know, there's that phrase, I be holy because I'm holy. And God, different. God is different. He's different from all other gods because he's the only one that actually is a god. And he doesn't want us to treat him like those pagan ideas or idols or anything like that. Anyways, chapter 18 is, I'll make the point, it's not for the priesthood, it's for people. I'm not going to read through all of it, but let's get a start. It says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. According to the doings of the land of Egypt where you dwelt, shall not do. According to the land of Canaan, according to the doings of the land of Canaan where I'm bringing you, you shall not do. Nor shall you walk in their ordinances. So don't be like the Egyptians where you used to live. Don't be like the Canaanites where you're going to live. I'm going to tell you how to live. Verse 5, you shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man does them, he'll live by them. And that can be interpreted a couple of ways. One is, doing this brings life. I'm telling you the right way that's going to give you a life. But it's also saying, or it could be interpreted as, look, don't do this just superficially. Live it. Believe it. Make it a part of you. And I'm not sure if from the Hebrew you can tell which is the meaning, but perhaps God did it that way so that you understand it's both. And he's going to go on, the rest of the chapter is pretty much going to talk about who you can marry and who you can't. And it's related largely to sexual immorality. I guess I can go ahead and read in verse 6. None of you shall approach anyone who is near of kin to him to uncover his nakedness. I am the Eternal. Nakedness of your father or the nakedness of your mother you shall not uncover. So it's relating to that, and he's purposely relating it to, the Egyptians, they lived a life that had sexual immorality. The Canaanites, they practiced sexual immorality, and this is by God's definition. And let's face it, sexual immorality has been common in every human society ever. You know, it's because of the way we're built. Sorry, I've got something written in my handwriting I can't read. Oh, yeah, what I was going to say is, without getting into a detailed explanation, there's no reason, and I've never heard anybody present one, to think that what the people were told to do or not do here would be good for us to follow. You know, nobody said, oh, that was just for ancient Israel. We should be able to marry our sisters, or anything like that. It's commonly agreed, okay, this is good. We don't want to find a way to get out of this. And this goes beyond the command that sex is permissible only within marriage. God already established that. Thou shalt not commit adultery. He's also said, thou shalt not commit fornication. So, the idea is sex is for within marriage. Now, this chapter is going to go forward to say who you can marry. Who can get married and who can't. And God makes the point that he and he alone has the authority to do so. Okay, he has the authority to make that decision. I'll make the point, this chapter just says don't. It does not answer the question of why not, or what. Don't do this or this will happen. Matter of fact, that applies to several of the chapters we've already gone through. I'm making the point because a couple of chapters from now, in chapter 20, you do get the or what. There's a list of punishments for some of the things we're covering here and in other chapters. I started going into it. None of you shall approach anyone who is near of kin to uncover his nakedness. We've got an English word for that today, right? Incest is the word. So basically he's saying don't commit incest. You can't have sex or marriage within family members. And I've got some terms that's worth noting. Uncover nakedness. Basically, all the scholars who have studied it say that refers to sexual relations. It doesn't mean just taking a peek. It means having sex. Also, you'll see the term lie with. That also doesn't mean sharing a couch and laying down. You could do that with someone that's near of kin. You could actually sleep next to each other, but having sexual relations, that's what it's talking about. You'll also see the phrase, the one word take. Like the uncle shall not take his niece, or And that seems to be referring to marriage, which generally includes sex. I say generally, I don't know of any cases where people intend for it not to. But it's the word has that meaning more so. Okay, so rather than read through all the awkward wording, I'll mention there are 8 specific relationships forbidden. Okay, and I'll list them for you. I'm not going to write them on the board because you'd have trouble reading, but one is a parent with a child. Don't do that. No parent-child. Also forbidden is step-parent with stepchild. So that's also out of bounds. Number 3 is grandparent with grandchild. And I hope if you're like me, you're going, ugh, you know, all this sounds really gross anyways. But God spells it out. I don't think I have a listing of this on the test, but I'm giving this for your information. Number 4 is full siblings, brother, sister, you know. But also then number 5 is half siblings. Okay, and you might start thinking, wait a minute, I've seen some examples in the Bible where someone did do this. I'll come to that later. Number 6 is an uncle with a niece or an aunt with a nephew. And it's interesting, I think God never presumes homosexuality in any of these. He assumes sexual relationships are always hetero, which is what he intended. So uncle with niece or aunt with nephew. Then in 7, a parent-in-law with a child-in-law. So I could say father-in-law with daughter-in-law or mother-in-law with son-in-law. It was easier in my writing to just do it parent and child. And then the 8th one is brother-in-law with sister-in-law. Okay, so what I was going to make note of, it's obvious that in earlier times in the Bible, in times of the patriarchs, not all of these were enforced. And we're left with a question, why? You know, remember at the beginning of the class, we talked about, okay, the question often comes up, because Canaan knew his wife, and she had, who did Cain and Abel marry? And all the other children of Adam and Eve. Well, it seems there must have been some of these relationships that are now forbidden that did happen. Yeah, Kayla? Oh, I was going to say, we don't know for sure. Some people have speculated that maybe their genetic structure was different. I could say with Adam and Eve, one of the things I speculated is that when God created Eve, he might have created all of her eggs to have different genetics. So that, you know, actually they weren't literally, they'd be the same as half-brothers and sisters, which is still forbidden here, but it's not quite as icky as full brothers and sisters. Icky is a theological term, by the way. So, Kayla,
I've heard of, for example, say your dad has a divorce and then he remarries, and then the niece, for example, of the new stepmother, the son that she's now, you know, in that family she's married into, he marries that stepmother's niece. Is that weird? I've heard of people doing that before.
Yeah, we could draw a chart, but the idea is near enough relatives aren't supposed to marry. And we know from common practice, basically a lot of times if people do that, there's increased chance of birth defects if they have children. Apparently the genetic structure doesn't, you know. And that's why I say in ancient times perhaps it didn't happen, and then God said, okay, now it's gotten this far, we got to change it. But this is me guessing as to, you know, for instance, Abraham married Sarah and she was his half-sister. And Abraham is the father of the faithful. Apparently at that time, God hadn't said, you can't do that. Why not? I honestly don't know for sure. Like I said, we can speculate on reasons, but the Bible doesn't provide a reason. But looking the other direction, as I've said, most people look at this and say, oh yeah, I agree with all that, you know, whether I like it or not. So I want to move to verse 18. Here's a new one that doesn't have to do with, you know, who you can or can't marry, other than it says you, and when it says you, this is generally seen as addressing men. So you, a man, shall not take a woman as a rival to her sister to uncover her nakedness while the other is alive. That's saying a man can't marry 2 living sisters. Again, we have an example. Jacob married both Rachel and Leah. Of course, we know he didn't do so intentionally, or he intended to marry Rachel and he got Leah, but then he went ahead and married Rachel and God gave them children. Of course, we could also say that didn't make for a real happy family environment. They were competing against each other. So to me, the story of Jacob with Rachel and Leah is a good example of why not to do this. But it does say while she's living. Apparently, I could Well, my wife didn't have any sisters. She only has brothers. It would be okay if I married her and say she died and I fell in love with her sister. That wouldn't violate this law. It might seem creepy to people, and I don't have any danger of that happening. Oh, yeah, the levirate marriage, as it's called, yeah. If they die without children. And here we see in verse 18, it says, while the other is alive. So there's the disclaimer. So if one sister dies, then okay, it's... Well, it says not to take her as a rival. So you don't have a rivalry with someone who's... And like I said, I don't think this is going to come up real often, but God's providing for this, okay? Verse 19, this is something that's more apt to be something we all have to be concerned with. You shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is in her customary impurity. Okay, when it's her time of the month, sex is off the table, is what he's saying. You're not allowed to do that. It doesn't say why. I've read different things. I've read things written by some doctors that say there's not really any harm in doing so. But I've heard some people say, yeah, there is. I've heard some say that there's an increased chance of bloodborne disease being shared. But some doctors say, no, that's ridiculous. And I don't know. I've read some people say it would increase discomfort or something. And obviously, I can't put myself in that situation. But God says, don't do it then. And that's something I think even people who say, yeah, even if this was something for the old, you know, for the Levitical ritual law, it doesn't seem that it is for that. It's something we abide by. So keep that in mind for when you're married. Okay, verse 20, you shall not lie with carnally with your neighbor's wife to defile yourself with her. Okay, so restatement of seventh commandment. No adultery, don't have sex with someone else's wife. Verse 21, and you shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of the Lord your God. I am the Eternal. Molech, it's interesting, small m, that was the Hebrew word that was also translated as king, at least in some places. But generally, when it's like this, it's referring to what, the false god that the Ammonites worshipped. And it's talking about child sacrifice. We know it was practiced in ancient times. I can give you a couple of references from the prophets, like Jeremiah 7, verse 31. Jeremiah 7, 31 and Ezekiel 23, 37 refers to giving children to Molech. From what I've read in historical archaeological accounts, say there are a couple of ways of doing this. These statues were generally made of metal and hollowed out, open in the back, so you could build a big fire inside it. And it had outstretched arms that led down to an opening, like, and sometimes portrayed as a large mouth. And as gruesome as it is, like, the idea is putting the baby on there and rolling them down into the fire. Now, one of the reasons I'm bringing that out is some had said, in some cases, they would do that, and what would they do is pass the baby between the arms. So the baby, and as a way of dedicating it to that false god without actually killing it as a sacrifice. And those who say, you know, this might be referring to that or referring to both, God would forbid both of those. God would condemn sacrificing children, obviously. And when it comes up in the prophets, that's one of the places he says, I never even imagined that. God says, it never even entered my mind. But he also doesn't want, even if you spare the child's life, don't dedicate it. Don't go through some ceremony saying, oh, this child is devoted to Molech. You know, that's not cool either. To 22, where it says, you should not lie with a male as with a woman. This is directed at men.
And this, it may just be in there randomly, but was there a sexual aspect to the child situation, because it's kind of just in there with everything.
That crossed my mind. I was going to comment, and I don't know for certain. I've wondered if it's because it's talking about offspring, you know, the result of sexual relationships sometimes is children. So maybe that's why it's there. Otherwise, we don't know. I do find it interesting, you know, here in verse 22 is a clear condemnation of homosexuality. I mentioned God doesn't allow for it when he's saying who you can't marry because it's not even considered a possibility. And God doesn't consider it an alternate lifestyle. Or if you're a fan of the old Seinfeld show where they said, not that there's anything wrong with that, God's saying, oh, there's something wrong with it. I find it intriguing because after that it goes on to verse 23, nor shall you mate with any animal to defile yourself, nor an animal. So men and women are both forbidden bestiality. Sex with animals is out of bounds. And I find it interesting that homosexuality is sandwiched in between child sacrifice and bestiality. So for people who would say, oh, nothing's wrong with homosexuality, God has it right there on the shelf next to those things that most people are going, ugh. I mean, the most liberal understanding or tolerant people in society today don't condone child sacrifice. And I think there are very few that condone bestiality, although who knows where we'll be next. So God puts those all there, and you know, his instruction is very clear. I mean, people don't like this. They'll say, oh, this was just something based on their archaic views in ancient times. But I think it's, as God keeps saying, I am the Lord your God. He includes that phrase telling us, I'm your maker. I get to decide. I'm different. I want you to be different. Oh, yeah, starting in verse 24, it says, don't defile yourselves with any of these things. For by all these, the nations are defiled, which I'm casting out before you. For the land is defiled. Therefore, I visit the punishment and the iniquity upon the land, and it vomits out its inhabitants. Now, you shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments. You shall not commit any of these abominations, either any one of your own nation or any stranger that dwells among you. For all these abominations the men of the land have done. So God's saying, I'm not just making this up. People do this stuff, and I don't want you to do it, lest the land vomit you out. Verse 29, for whoever commits any of these abominations, the persons who commit them shall be cut off from their people. Therefore, you'll keep my ordinance so that you don't commit any of these abominable customs. So I'll leave there, but God is saying, he's disagreeing with people who say, oh, well, whatever you do in the privacy of your own bedroom is your business. God is saying, no, it defiles the land. It's not just your business, it's a national business. You know, the land is defiled by this. And anybody that does this, he talks about being cut off. I mean, I think I covered this earlier, but it's uncertain exactly what cut off would mean, and perhaps it has more than one meaning, because it seems to imply, like, there's one thought is that it means banishment. Like, you got to leave the country. You're not allowed to live here anymore. A much lesser punishment would say you're not allowed to participate in the ritual system. You can't come to the tabernacle and sacrifice. And there are some who have interpreted it to say, no, it means execution. You're going to be cut off from the land of the living. There's room to wonder, but in any case, it's something God forbids and says there will be a strong punishment for it. And I haven't leaned strongly one way or the other of where I thought that came. Funny, I thought I was going to cover that chapter in about 10 minutes, but... Okay, I did plan to spend more time on chapter 19, though. Now, some people would describe 19 as covering what are called sundry laws. And you see that term come up sometimes here, certainly in Deuteronomy, which means a miscellany. And we don't use the term sundries very often anymore. If you watch any old movies or something, it used to be they'd take a department store. You know, there'd be an operator, and he'd take you up to the fifth floor and say, you know, men's hosiery, women's whatever, and sundries. Sundries means odds and ends, different things. But I would say I'm not sure that this is just a hodgepodge. One of the things I see in this is God giving a reason for a lot of the things he wants people to do. And let's start at the beginning of the chapter to make some of this case. Is it? And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Okay, again, I think this is a powerful statement. God is saying, I'm holy. I'm different. I want you to be holy and be different. And this is quoted, remember we covered it, and I don't have it written down here, in 1 Peter. Peter quoted from this when he was writing to the church. 1 Peter 1:15, as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, be holy for I am holy. So the apostles, after Christ came and was crucified and resurrected, are hearkening back saying, we as the Christian church, not the nation of Israel, still have an obligation to be holy. And that tells us if we want to be holy, maybe we should look here to some of the instruction God gives for what you do to be holy. And so we look at some of this, and a lot of it's common sense. It fits with our different lifestyle. Verse 3, every one of you shall revere his father and mother and keep my Sabbaths. Okay, so a holy people keeps the Sabbath. They treat their parents proper with respect. And verse 4, don't turn to idols, nor make them for yourselves molded gods. I'm the Lord your God. Okay, idolatry. You know, obey the first and the second commandment. And I would say no syncretism is ever allowed. You know, God says, I don't want you to take little pieces of other religions and mix them in. Keep it the way I tell you. And it's through this chapter, I haven't gone through and enumerated, but several of the Ten Commandments are listed here. Now, he didn't have to. He gave them at Mount Sinai, so it's not like we don't have them in the Bible. But it seems like he's bringing it back to, okay, you're a holy people. This is the way you live. Now, this isn't for the priest what to do in the tabernacle. This is for all of us to make our lives different in the way God wants them. Now, he does relate something next to the sacrifices. In verse 5, if you offer a sacrifice of a peace offering to the Lord, it has to be of your own free will. Worship of God shouldn't be forced. You know, you should want to do this, which that could be interpreted. I remember when my sister was 16 and didn't want to go to Sabbath services anymore, and she finally told my mom, I'm only going because you make me go, and finally my mom said, fine, I'm not going to make you. And sadly, my sister stopped going. I don't know when the time comes. You know, Connor's going to come to church every Sabbath. He doesn't get that choice. But I'm hoping by the time he's old enough to know the difference, he'll want to. It'll be of his free will. Anyways, and he goes on to give some description about that. Offer it of your own free will. Verse 6, it shall be eaten in the same day you offer it, and the next day. If any of it remains the third day, it shall be burned in the fire. If it's eaten at all on the third day, it's an abomination. So remember, this peace offering was something that could be shared with family and friends, unlike the sin offerings. You know, it was a happy thing. But still, God didn't want it taken lightly. Even though it's not as sobering and solemn as other sacrifices, it's a great happy occasion, still treat it with the proper respect. You're given 2 days. After that, you got to burn it. You can't make sandwiches with it after that. Going on, verses 9 and 10, it mentions gleaning. And Mr. Lee brought that up. When you reap the harvest of your land, don't wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings. You shall not glean your vineyard, nor gather every grape. Leave them for the poor and the stranger. I'm the Lord your God. So God set aside part of every crop for the poor of the land. But they would have to do some work to get it. You know, I've often thought, and I've had people point it out to me that, you know, there's an improvement over the welfare system of a lot of countries where, okay, the poor are provided for, but they don't get a check in the mailbox and then go back to watching Oprah. They have to go out and do some work. And okay, that's maybe an unfair stereotype. But the way Mr. Lee pointed out, if you have those resources, don't gobble it all up. Don't go back and get every little thing. Leave some for others. And we could interpret that in our society to devote some of your energy and resources to helping others. And I'm thrilled we have people who do that. And matter of fact, I mentioned to Mrs. Waterhouse, she's thanking me for devoting resources to, you know, those things. I said, that was just a couple $100. You guys devoting your time was worth a lot more than that. Yes, Nate? You mean don't use it all yourself, give it to leaving it for an inheritance? I think you might be able to apply the principle somewhat, but this is specifically talking about your increase, you know, when you grow. It's like we tithe on our increase, not on our total assets. So I think there's some different principles would come into play. You know, and I think of some very rich people studying 19th century history, you know, like Andrew Carnegie and John Rockefeller had some qualms about leaving billions of dollars to their children. Because they said, that might ruin them if they never have to work. So Carnegie set up the Carnegie Foundation and other things to try to give away all of his money, which probably disappointed his kids. They're probably thinking, hey, I'd like some of that. But he wanted them to have to work. So I don't know. There's different things that would come into play. But I don't think this is specifically referring to inheritance. Okay, let's look at verses 11 through 13. Don't steal, don't deal falsely, nor lie to one another. Again, we're dealing with some of the Ten Commandments. You shall not swear by my name falsely or profane the name of your God. You shall not cheat your robber, nor rob the wages of him who's hired. Cheat your neighbor, nor rob him, and the wages of him who is hired shall not remain with you all night. Again, we could tie this together with the idea of be honest, deal honestly with people. Pay your fair share, don't take advantage of people. You could say Israel was to be a land of truth and justice. And I would say in the American way, but this isn't Superman, it's the Bible. But that's the way God wants. I've got my notes. The way the country was to be run was not by the golden rule, as the modern society says the golden rule, which is No, that's Jesus' golden rule. Modern society says he that has the gold makes the rules. But God is saying, no, not. That's not what God wants. He wants us all to deal honestly and justly, pay a fair wage. Let's look at verse 15. It says, You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. So this fits, by the way, with, where is that? Oh, James 2, verses 1 through 9, where James talked about not showing partiality. James didn't just make that up, and he wasn't inspired by God with an idea that didn't exist in the Old Testament. It's here. Don't show partiality, not just, he doesn't only say don't show partiality to the rich and the powerful, because they might do you a favor. Also, don't show partiality to the poor. This fits in with be fair, even-handed. You know, don't take advantage of people because you can. But also, you know, I can say God doesn't condone a lot of the ideas of communism or socialism. You don't look at someone who has a lot and say, he probably doesn't deserve that. We better take some of it away. You say, no, that's partiality. You know, treat everyone fairly. You know, you could make a case against regressive tax structures for this, but I don't want to get into that because I use the term and I'm not always clear exactly what regressive tax structures mean. Think of the idea as you tax people at a higher rate if they make more money. The scripture in James, well, I mentioned James 2, 1 through 9. We're in Leviticus 19, verse 15. So again, fair dealing. Don't favor the poor, don't favor the rich. Moving on to verse 16. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the eternal. Notice a lot of these phrases end with that phrase again, I am the eternal. I think that's a shorthand for what he says at the beginning. Be holy, for I am holy. He's reminding you, hey, this is me. I'm holy. I'm telling you this so you can be holy. That term go about, I understand the Hebrew implies like someone who travels about as a peddler or like a door-to-door salesman. So go about, it doesn't just mean, hey, did you hear this? But going about actively promoting it, like selling it, which makes me think of tabloids and TV shows, which I got to be careful. I see Extra on a lot of times at night because I like Mario. Is Mario, what's his last name? Lopez. I almost said Mario Segli, and I was thinking, no, that's a different Mario. Shows how many I know. But, you know, some of the businesses in life seem to at least verge on going about peddling, you know, tail-bearing to talk about gossiping. God's not in favor of that. Verses 17 and 18, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear your sin. So, kind of, don't hate him, but rebuke him. To some people, that seems like a contradiction. But I don't think it is. In verse 18, you shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And there it is, I am the eternal. We know that love your neighbor as yourself, right? Christ called that the second great commandment. That's like the first one. It's in Matthew 22, verse 39, is one of the places where he says that. You know, the lawyer asked him, what's the greatest commandment of the law? You know, in one version it says, well, what do you read? And he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your might. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. These aren't unrelated. That's why I read verses 18 or 17 and 18 together. One of the ways you show love to your neighbor sometimes is by correcting him. And I've addressed that from the other end several times in the general epistles. James 5, verses 19 and 20. And also 1 Peter 4, 8, I would say this addresses partly how love covers sin, or love covers a multitude of sin, is because if in love you correct your brother and help him to stop sinning, then you're helping him to have his sins covered. And likewise, as you, if my brothers, one of you come to me and say, Dr. Dunkel, you're sinning. I'm sinning, how dare you? Well, you're doing this, oh. Hopefully I would say, you're right, I am so sorry, I've got to change that. I could go repent before God, and you've shown love to me, helping me to see my mistake and change. And of course, I also tied that into Matthew 18, verse 15. I would say we can make the case for our modern society that tolerance of sin is not showing love. This would say it's the opposite. You know, so we want to be tolerant of people's differences. That's a lot of what these personality tests and such are about. You know, I'm an ISTJ. It's funny, Mrs. Fenchel was saying, you know, Matt Fenchel is the same letters as me, and she's the exact opposite. When I ruined that, I thought, you know, I think I know why her and I have worked so well together at summer camp. Because she's been married to Matt all these years, so she learned how to put up with someone like that. So when we got to work together at camp, she was able to put up with me. But that's the kind of tolerant that's good. But tolerating sin is not showing love. You know, it's just an alternate lifestyle. It's just whatever. You know, His word doesn't show that. Okay, I don't want to beat this to death. Let's move on to verse 19. You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your livestock breed with another kind. You shall not sow your field with mixed seed, nor shall a garment of mixed linen and wool come upon you. Okay, there I got to stop, because this scripture has caused confusion, partly because the reasons for the prohibition and how that applies to us today is not entirely clear. Now, most scholars think that all three of these were used by pagan religions as part of their worship, in Canaan in particular. Okay, so it's widely believed, and I think it's probably true, God is saying, hey, remember, we'd already read, he said, don't do what they did in Egypt, and don't do what they do in Canaan. I'm going to tell you how to live my way. So he's saying, don't have your livestock interbreed. You know, don't sow your field with mixed things, and don't have a garment that's made of linen and woolen together. Now, that leads to the question of, like, well, if I'm not doing it as part of a pagan worship, can I interbreed livestock? And people have come up with different answers to that. And I'm still not sure. Like, there are hybrids, and I'm not sure, you could argue, does this mean I can't have a Hereford interbreed with an Angus? You know, or does it mean I can't have a cow interbreed with a zebra? And I don't think you'd have much luck with that anyways. And I'm just raising this because the question is there, and you could make argument. A lot of people think it's referring to, you know, inferior results. A lot of hybrids are inferior, and God could be saying, don't do that. There is this one line of thought that says this is dealing with false marketing, so to speak. Like, a garment that's made of linen and wool might look like it's a high, expensively made wool garment, but really half of it's not, and it's really inferior. So, you know, don't market something as being something it's not. That's one explanation that could be. I will mention linen and wool, and there was a time in American history where a lot of poor people wore that. It was called Lindsay Woolsey, which I remember because Abraham Lincoln wore Lindsay Woolsey when he was a youth. That's where I remember it, but a lot of other people did. And it was inferior. You know, those two mixtures don't go together. And by the way, I printed out some of our old personal correspondence letters. Yeah, I could read a paragraph that says, today we would call this a consumer protection law. This was a book I got in 1987, I think. Notice that these verses contain the basic principle that materials of widely differing character and texture are not to be combined. On the other hand, these verses do allow a number of combinations which are within God's law. There are two basic kinds of natural fibers from which today's garments are made. The first is plant cellulose fiber. Fabrics such as linen and cotton are produced from it. The second is animal protein fiber. Materials such as wool and silk are in this category. Because these two basic kinds of fibers differ markedly in strength and washability, absorption, and so forth, they should not be mixed. However, a garment made of a combination of cellulose fibers, say a mixture of cotton and linen, for example, is acceptable because the fibers are basically similar. Mixtures of protein fibers, wool, mohair, silk, and so on, are acceptable. Then what about a mixture of synthetic man-made fabrics like dacron, nylon, polyester, and rayon, you know, with either cellulose, you know, plant cellulose or protein? You know, well, it says they wouldn't necessarily break this principle, but generally artificial fibers are made to be like something that's natural, and you don't want to mix the ones that are unlike, but generally that's not done because it's not effective. So this is the kind of thing where you get into trying to see how does this apply and how does it not. And I don't have as much about, I guess this is the question comes up. Most people aren't planting fields or mixing livestock today, but people wonder, can I go to Walmart and buy a cotton polyester garment? And in general, our answer is, yeah, you can, that's okay. I mean, this specifically says wool and linen. It doesn't forbid anything else, but I think the general types, that sort of bears up. Oh, yeah. There had been some discussion of how this wool-linen combination could create static electricity. And I've read some accounts where that degrades the health, but also some that, you know, the pagans would wear something like that to build up a charge, and they could like make like sparks fly or shock people, and it made them seem like they were connected to the gods. And the true God is saying, no, I don't want you doing that. Yes, Ezekiel.
Because linen is a summer garment, and wool is a winter garment.
Yes.
If you use both the combination, it will be too hot in the summertime.
That's interesting. Yeah, good point.
It wouldn't serve the purpose of a winter.
Yeah, I know. Like this time of year, I got some wool sweaters, and a lot of them I bought at the thrift store cheap, but you go look for pure wool, that'll keep you warm. Not to mention wool will retain its insulating qualities even if it's wet, which cotton doesn't. So yeah, if you're going to winter camp, I bought a whole bunch of wool things when I was going to camp, including I've got a stocking cap made of wool, which is one of my prized possessions. And I think I got it for $1. That brings to mind something when we were going through the latter chapters of Ezekiel. One place where it mentions during their duties, the priests had to wear garments made of linen, not wool. And it specifically says they can't wear anything that'll make them sweat. So God didn't want stinky priests sweating up the place. But that fits with what Ezekiel was saying. Some types of garments are good for keeping you warm. Some will breathe better. Okay, so maybe that's enough said on that. I think it's a topic that has been studied in great detail. And I think we can understand it without getting bogged down too much. Yeah, Kayla?
The one with mixed seed. So what were they saying that the Canaanites did with mixed seed that was...
I don't know. I've heard that Canaanites used it somehow, but I haven't heard a detailed description of how exactly. Yeah, well, let's move on. It made me think, I know when supposedly the pilgrim story of the Indians teaching them how to plant corn and then have the beans go around the corn climbing up, some would say, well, is that wrong? I don't know anybody that does it in modern farming today, but you could make a case that one of the things I say, if you have any doubt or if it pricks your conscience, don't do it. You know, if you're in the store thinking about buying this jacket and say, I'm not sure if these two fibers should be mixed, don't buy it. And if you're not sure if you should let climbing beans circle around your corn stalk, don't plant them that way. And I've never done that, so like I said, I err on the side of not violating these principles. I try to never just say, oh, it's fine, you know, that doesn't apply to us. You know, and most of it's not difficult to live with anyways. Okay, I want to move on to verse 20. Whoever lies carnally with a woman who is betrothed to a man as a concubine and has not at all been redeemed nor given her freedom, for this there shall be scourging, but they shall not be put to death because she was not free. And he shall bring his trespass offering to the Lord to the door of the tabernacle, meeting a ram of a trespass. And the priest shall make atonement for him. The ram of the trespass offering before the Lord is a sin which he has committed, and it will be forgiven him. This addresses punishment for fornication with a woman who's not free, and it seems to be saying the status, her legal status, affects the punishment, giving more leniency because of her not being free, being under someone's control. Now, this is one I say, maybe because we don't have slavery today, it's a hard concept for me to grasp. It's easier to understand why she would be shown leniency. And I think studying antebellum history in America, you know, a lot of slaves were imposed upon by their owners. And you could easily say they weren't guilty, especially like a woman who's raped is not guilty of adultery. Why is the man giving a lesser punishment? I'm sure there's a reason, but I'm not sure what it is. It seems to be relating to her status of being somewhat partially considered as property. But I don't want to claim I can tell you it's this and I know it's... Yeah, you know, this is one that I don't see any way of exercising this in our society because, you know, adultery is adultery and all of it falls under Romans 6:23. But it seemed that in their civil law, there was a difference made. There was still guilt, there was still a penalty, but the penalty wasn't as severe. And I wish I could say this is exactly why that was. Unfortunately, you know, I'd be bluffing and I might be wrong and have my bluff called. I'd rather just say I don't know for sure. And that's another one, when Christ comes, I'll say, can you explain this one to me? I've been teaching this class, and I had to say I don't know.